Our next and final program of today is provided by the Colorado Humanities, which is supported in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Colorado Humanities inspires the people of Colorado to explore ideas and to appreciate our diverse cultural heritage. Again, good evening. We have a special guest joining us tonight from her summer home in Newport, Rhode Island. Mrs. J.J. Brown spent the majority of her early life here in Colorado. However, since her survival of the Titanic, she has traveled the country speaking on issues of great concern. Mrs. Brown will share her experience aboard the Titanic with us tonight, but she arrived a few days here in Colorado a few days ago in response to the unfortunate happenings in southeast Colorado regarding the coal miners there. She is here to raise awareness and support for the miners and their families. After Mrs. Brown speaks with us, she will give you opportunity to ask questions, but for now, relax and join me in the year 1914, where we are at dinner in Denver and are joined by none other than Mrs. J.J. Brown.
I'm very honored to be here in my home state of Colorado. However, I'm met with much sadness regarding the situation just north of Trinidad. I'm sure that many of you have read the accounts in the newspapers regarding the coal miners' strike. They wanted better wages, improved working conditions. It is now being called the Ludlow Massacre. And rightly so. The death of the miners is devastating. But to know that women and children were buried in a tunnel dug by their own husbands to protect them from a spray of bullets is a tragedy. I would like to thank the Denver United Workers Garments Union for inviting me here to help with this and to raise awareness and funds for the families who have been affected by this tragedy. I'm very well aware of the mining conditions they work in, being that I spent my early life in Leadville. I know many of you may regard me as the wife of a very wealthy mine owner, and maybe you think I'm here to side with the mine owners, such as J.D. Rockefeller, but I'm not. I will not take sides. I am here to aid the families affected by this tragedy in any way that I can. I've spent my life working to take money from the rich and give to the poor. There has been no restitution by Governor Ammons or J.D. Rockefeller for the families involved on either side of this tragedy. So I've been asked to come. I've sent a corps of nurses down south, and as soon as they report back to me, we will begin to raise funds for the families. I've granted this lecture among many others. Why? I probably wouldn't even have this platform to speak to you from if it would not have been for almost the exact same type of situation I was given just a couple of years ago on the maiden voyage of the Titanic. I was enjoying a much-needed, relaxing trip to Europe with my daughter Helen and the John Jacob Astor party. We traveled to Rome. I bought ancient ruin replicas to bring back to the Denver Art Museum. We traveled to Cairo, where I picked up many small Egyptian good luck charms. On my way back to Paris, I was met with a telegram from my son. Mother, come quick. Your grandson is ill. my grandson. I haven't even laid eyes on the grandchild, although I'd anticipated his arrival for quite some time. Why, all that would change. I booked passage on the first steamer back to America, the Titanic. We waited for almost an hour in the freezing cold for an already late ship. We were all in small tender. Well, they call it small, and perhaps up against the keel of the Titanic. It was small. But truly, it was large enough to carry hundreds of passengers, baggage and mail, to what would become the tomb of many of us. Why, Emma. Emma Bucknell. How are you? My dear, I haven't seen you in a long, long time. Margaret, I have a bad premonition. A bad premonition, an evil boding on this ship. Oh, my dear, not to worry. You're just nervous, anxious to see your children and your grandchildren. What is taking them so long? Emma's conversation reminded me of another event happened while in Cairo. Strolling through the Egyptian bazaar with John Jacob Astor and his new wife, Madeline, I'm one for fortune and a game of truth. A small Egyptian man took my hand. He began to read my poem. Water, water, sinking ship and floating body. Why, you crazy old man. You know I'm American and I have to go back across the water to get home. You won't get another cent out of me. I do say, it has been over an hour. I think everyone is chilled to the bone. Yes, Emma, I do believe it's just nerves. Why, look there. The tunnels of the Titanic. Oh, a master palace of the sea. Come, time to board. While on steamers, first-class passengers often recognized each other from social circles in New York, Paris, and London. Emma and I ran into Dr. Arthur Brew, a physician from Philadelphia. Dr. Brew, Emma says she has a premonition, bad premonition about this ship. Dr. Brew tried to console Emma. Oh, not to worry. This ship is built like no other. That night, found most people in their staterooms, for first class had electric heaters and warm blankets. And even the dinner bell and the inner cravings of a man would not call them out. Brisk morning followed. Perfect time to walk the deck. Perhaps see old friends. Meet new ones. Why, Mr. and Mrs. Thayer, how do you do? Beautiful morning for a walk, I do agree. Yes. Oh, will you be joining us tonight in the dining area? Sitting at the captain's table, of course. Yes, I saw you there last time we traveled together. Mrs. Carter, it's so nice to see you. What a beautiful new wrap. Did you pick that up in Paris? Oh, Madeline. Madeline, my dear. Mrs. Carter. Mrs. Carter, Madeline Astor. Madeline, I wanted to go to the Palm Garden and warm up in the sun. Perhaps read a book. Would you like to join me? As Madeline and I walked toward the Palm Garden, we could overhear the conversations regarding the marvels of the Titanic. Why, isn't that your husband? John Jacob Astor, how do you do? Are we on schedule? The amount of knots covered every day was posted at noon and was the topic of every luncheon hour. Following lunch, many retired to the reading room with a very well-equipped library supplied their books. Every day for me was the same. A brisk walk along the deck, followed by 2 hours of reading in the reading room, a little bit of exercise, dry toast and tea, before dressing for dinner. While in Paris, Helen and I went shopping. I bought several new dresses. 25, to be exact. 14 hats to match. Besides, no one was in their stateroom because the sea was perfectly calm and not a vibration was felt. Which further made Dr. Brew's comment about the safety of the ship more believable. Sunday morning, just like every other morning on the ship, a little cooler, and with the exception of Sunday service, which was held in the first class dining hall. Captain Smith greeted every first class passenger with a nod. How do you do, Captain Smith? I hear you'll be retiring when we reach New York. Well, I've enjoyed many of our travels together, and I'm going to miss you next time around. Service wasn't like that of the cathedral in Denver or the Annunciation Church in Leadville where JJ and I married long ago. And the distinction between first, second, and third class was noted by the seating arrangement. But the service was full of spirit and strong. I looked forward to dinner that night. I joined Dr. Brew and Emma. Filet mignon and a glass of champagne. Perhaps a touch of dessert and coffee if I was willing to walk the deck one more time. Emma, you haven't hardly slept a wink since we've been here. What is wrong?
Oh, Margaret, shouldn't he be on deck or something? I've heard rumors of icebergs and such.
Oh, Emma, my dear, you worry about everything. There's nothing to worry about. I keep telling you.
Dr. Brew, tell her.
Yes, Emma, my dear. Everything is fine. They always hire Captain Smith to maiden voyages. He's never had a problem on the sea. Besides, he always joins first-class passengers for dinner.
Come, Emma, let's get your heavy coat, and Dr. Brew can get his overcoat. We'll go to the Palm Garden and listen to ragtime. Perhaps that will calm your nerves. It was about 10 p.m. when I retired to my room, anxious to read my book. I stretched out on the brass bed beside the lamp. It took me back to a day when small cabin outside of Leadville. We couldn't even leave the lamps burning into the night. Hello? You there? What was that? Nothing to worry about, is it? Wonder if those women can swim in those kimonos. Hello? Who's there? Hello? Somebody there? Then I saw him through my window, face blanched, eyes protruding like a haunted creature. He said, get your life preserved. Get your life preserved. 7 pairs of wool socks. That ought to do. My warmest outfit. Sable stole.
$500.
Good luck, statue.
A picture of my grandson.
Sir, where do I go? I went to the storm deck as I was instructed. There I saw over 50 passengers struggling to put on their life belts. There I also saw Emma. Emma! Margaret, I told you something bad was going to happen. I told you something bad was going to happen. We went to the storm deck as we were instructed. There was confusion. Lifeboats were being lowered with much difficulty. We stood, watching in horror.
Women and children only! Women and children only!
Officer Lighthouser had to yell over the steam coming out of the safety valves, for it was deafening. Some people thought this was no nonchalant, and others were terrified, while some women held back, didn't want to leave their husbands, thought the whole thing was unnecessary. I stood and thanked God that Helen stayed back in Paris. For who's to say what one decision or one moment in life can change everything?
Into the boat! Into the boat!
I turned to see who Lighthouser was hollering at. Why, it was Madame de Villiers. She grabbed my arm, a friend of mine from Paris. Madame, please, do as the officer tells you. Get into the boat.
No, Margaret, no, I cannot. I've left everything in my room, my jewelry, my money, everything.
Please, just get into the boat as the officer tells you. It's just a precaution. We'll be able to come back to the ship soon.
No, I will not.
I was able to convince Madame to get into the ship, into the lifeboat. As soon as I turned to go to the other side of the ship and find out what was going on the other side, I was grabbed from behind and dropped a full 4 feet into lifeboat number 6. We tossed forward and back. I thought we would capsize. And as we came down past deck D, the porthole had water coming out. I reached for the oar and pushed us away, as far as I could, holding us back from the water. We finally reached the sea. And there I looked to the promenade deck. It was Captain Smith, his white whiskers, white dinner jacket. Row to the light. Keep the boats together and row to the light. Row, dear. As I began to row, I realized there was no light. We rowed for what seemed like hours with nothing but the stars to light our way. I swore I wouldn't look back, but when someone in the boat said, "The ship," I turned. And I couldn't take my eyes off of that master palace of the sea. As the stern suspended against the sky, and the sound of paddles almost drowned out, cries of terror. Dear God. And then the sea opened up like giant foaming arms and took the vessel down. And it was quiet.
We were the last boat to reach the side of the Carpathia.
As the sun began to rise, the smell of icebergs was like a steelyard, venomous. After much difficulty and bouncing off the side of the ship 3 or 4 times, we were finally each hoisted up by a rope, where we were met with coffee and stimulants and warm blankets. We were asked our name and class. Margaret Tobin Brown, first class. We were assigned sleeping arrangements according to class. I immediately started to work to organize a survivors committee. My studies of different languages helped me with many of the immigrants and foreign-born survivors who had lost husbands, children, possessions, and even papers that could possibly send them back home when they reached America. By the time we reached New York, I had organized the Survivors Committee, was named chair, and raised almost $10,000 for the survivors of the Titanic. I was met with much resistance. Statements such as, "Why, Mrs. Brown, why do you care? You have a representative from the Ritz-Carlton meeting you, and I have one from the Waldorf. Why bother? Why bother? Why bother, I ask? I stayed on that ship until every last survivor had a place to go. And when I found out from my brother Daniel, who had taken a train from Denver to New York, that my grandson was going to be fine, I set up quarters in New York and stayed until every last survivor had a place to stay or relatives were contacted. When I came back to Denver, I was received with open arms. Why, even Mrs. Crawford? Held a luncheon in my honor after years of not allowing me to be part of Denver society. I do think I've been misrepresented to my city, for I don't believe that I did anything any one of you wouldn't have done given same circumstances. I was not allowed to testify in the hearings of the Titanic because I am a woman. However, I wrote my account for 3 different newspapers. I do think that it was said best by Senator Smith during the Titanic hearings. He declared the disaster a result of greed. He said, "We are running mad with the lust of wealth, power, and ambition. We have separated society into castes, and it has taken a terrible warning to bring us back to our senses." Why, I say running the Titanic into that iceberg was as unnecessary as running the Brown Palace into Pike's Peak. For sprinkled among the sea that night were sisters of affluent, second, and third class, brought together by the proximity of death. The death of these miners is just as unnecessary. These strikes are more and more frequent across our country. Last year, 100 or more foreign-born young girls died in the Shirtwaist Company in New York after being locked in the building following a strike and a fire broke out. I think that the less you think of yourself during times like these, the better off you are. President Wilson addressed Congress and said, "In a time where people are being treated differently by rich or poor, we must abolish everything that resembles privilege." I am here today to ask you to help with the Ludlow Massacre in any way that you can, in assisting these families with anything that you may have. Like I said, I am here to grant lectures, newspaper interviews. There will be a benefit held in Denver on the 8th of May. I invite all of you to come. In fact, when I leave here today, I will join a group of women who will march in front of the Colorado Iron and Fuel Company. Well, we hope to get a rise out of J.D. Rockefeller. I say we bring international attention to this situation. But before I go, I do have time for a few questions.
Are there questions for Mrs. Brown? Yes, in the back there.
Did your friend Emma survive?
Did my friend Emma Bucknell survive? She did. I don't know that she'll ever take another ship, though. Anywhere. She doesn't want to join. Yes.
Astor?
John Jacob Astor did not survive the Titanic. His wife did.
I was just going to ask, your husband, did he
he survive or die?
He did not go. I was the only one, and I bought passage only because my grandson was ill. I was not meant to be on the Titanic. My daughter stayed in Paris. My husband and I are separated at the moment. We are very strong Catholics and will never get divorced, but we are separated.
In the back.
How would you like to see the city of Denver in the future?
I worked very hard over the 25 years that I spent improving Denver up until now. I moved to Colorado when I was 18. Built parks, helped with the juvenile system, Judge Ben Lindsay. And I do believe and hope that Denver itself grows to be a place where all cultures and all races and all levels of income and people can live. And there's things that all of them can enjoy.
Over here, Dory.
What would you say is the driving force behind your wanting to do these works, not only for Denver, but for the people who are underprivileged, and or why you felt that you needed to do what you did during the Titanic?
My father was a very hardworking man. Total, we had six children. I moved to Colorado because I wanted to marry a rich man. Give my father a place to put his feet up. He didn't have to work another day in his life. I started working when I was 13 in a tobacco factory. My family was Irish and Catholic. I saw a lot of underprivileged time in my life. I did not marry a rich man. I felt it was better to marry for love, not for money. However, 7 years after JJ and I married, he became a very, very wealthy man, giving me the opportunity to help people just like people had helped me. And that's the driving force behind what I do. I've been on both sides. And now I have the opportunity to help others.
Over here.
Why did Mrs. Crawford not want you involved in Denver's
story? I was new money. She believed that she came across her wealth the right way, and I didn't. And I came to Denver with a lot of ideas and a lot of things that I wanted to do and accomplish. She was the leader of the Sacred 36, and she wanted to keep it that way. Yes?
How about, like, gender inequality? Does that play into your thinking on equality as a whole?
I am a huge activist for women's rights. That's why I live my summers in Newport. It is a haven for the work that needs to be done for women in this country. It's also why I wrote my account for the papers. I do, in my own opinion, believe it's one of the best accounts there is. And I don't know if anyone will ever hear the accounts that were said and recorded in court. Children's rights, workers' rights, women's rights. All things that we all need to work on.
Yes. Did you have a mentor or a friend from old money who did help you to bridge the gap between your new money world and into the Elite 36, or was it really just all Molly Brown?
I'm not sure everybody heard that question. Would you repeat that one?
Did I have a mentor or a friend that old money that would have helped me transition into my new life found riches? No, not necessarily. 9 months after we became wealthy overnight, we moved to Denver. We bought a house that had been lost by the silver crash of 1893 by the man who built it based on the money he had made from the silver boom. My husband created a dolomite sand to go underneath the dolomite sand and start re-mining the gold. So once the silver crash came, then the gold he re-mined, and we became wealthy. A lot of people had lost a lot within that few months right before we made our money. And that may have been one of the reasons that we weren't quite as accepted as others. I felt I had a job to do. It necessarily doesn't matter to me if anyone wants to help or not.
When here in France?
I wondered what caused the separation. Was it different lifestyle aims, you and J.J., or what?
J.J. Brown believed that a woman's name should only appear in the paper 3 times, when she's born, when she gets married, and when she dies. I do not agree with that, and therefore we live in separate houses. I have never met another man who comes close to him. He is by far the greatest man I've ever known. However, we do not live and cannot live together. Thank you very much.